Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Gothic Tales by Arthur Conan Doyle, edited by Daryl Jones, narrated by Gary Furlong. Introduction. Arthur Conan Doyle is the greatest genre writer Britain has ever produced. Over the course of a long and very prolific career, he earned enormous popularity and public acclaim, some degree of political influence, a knighthood, a very large amount of money, and towards the end of his life, no little scorn and ridicule. He was a forceful personality, a big man, proud of his physique, strong and active, he called himself, and a man of considerable intelligence, of boundless energy, and of unassailable self-confidence. These were qualities which he brought to bear on a variety of endeavours, but especially upon the writing of fiction, of which he produced a great amount in an astounding variety of genres. Writers are not always the best judges of their own work. To a significant degree, Doyle owed his fame and success to the creation of Sherlock Holmes, a true literary immortal whose international celebrity and marketability show no signs of dwindling. Doyle is unquestionably one of the most important writers in the history of crime fiction, and yet Holmes was increasingly a source of irritation to his creator, who was convinced that his real talents lay elsewhere. As far as he was concerned, his lasting achievements were in the genre of historical fiction. Looking back on his career in his 1924 autobiography, Memories and Adventures, Doyle identified the 14th-century historical romances The White Company, 1891, and Sir Nigel, 1906, as the most complete, satisfying thing that I have ever done. All things find their level, but I believe that if I had never touched Holmes, who has tended to obscure my higher work, my position in literature would at the present moment be a more commanding one. As well as being a hyper-successful crime writer and a somewhat frustrated historical novelist, Doyle was also a great writer of imperial adventure fiction, notably with the first of the Professor Challenger novels, The Lost World, 1912. He wrote pirate stories, the Captain Sharkey series, and with his boxing stories made a distinguished contribution to sporting fiction. While a combination of public clamour and financial wisdom saw him returning intermittently to Holmes across his career, reluctantly acknowledging that, "I do not wish to be ungrateful to Holmes, who has been a good friend to me in many ways," there was one genre which he revisited again and again, with great enthusiasm. Arthur Conan Doyle was a major figure in the great period of the history of the Gothic tale. Dismissed for much of the 20th century as a cheap brand of populist melodrama, over recent decades the Gothic has become understood as a major cultural mode for the articulation of uncertainty and anxiety. With its characteristic tensions between past and present, rational scientific naturalism, and the irrational and supernatural, centre and periphery, the country and the city, the Gothic drew together many of Doyle's concerns. It provided him with a vehicle to express his divided national identity and double consciousness. It gave form to his anxieties, unarticulable in official public discourse, about the moral mission of the British Empire. It allowed him to explore, from the very beginning of his writing career, those possibilities of metaphysics and extreme states of being, disallowed within the realist economy of orthodox literary fiction. "We have in our police reports realism pushed to its extreme limits," Dr. Watson suggests. The Gothic tale allowed Doyle's imagination to venture far beyond even these limits. The range of stories in this volume is compendious, taking in the full panoply of the Victorian Gothic imagination's preoccupations: spiritualism, supernaturalism and the occult, colonial, Egyptomaniac and yellow peril horrors, medical and surgical horrors, psychological tales of madness, obsession and murder, tales of precognition and the uncanny. Doyle was fortunate to be writing at a time when the literary marketplace was especially amenable to his own particular talents. The hegemony of the classic Victorian three-decker novel came to a crashing end in the 1890s. By 1897, the number of three-volume novels published annually in Britain had fallen to four. The three-decker novel was the distinctive product of an effective cartel of publishers and librarians, which kept the prices of novels artificially and ultimately unsustainably high. Into the vacuum created by the demise of the three-decker poured a great number of new periodicals, most notably the Strand magazine, founded 1891, but also the Idler, 1892, and the Pall Mall magazine, 1893, and itself an offshoot of the Pall Mall Gazette, founded 1865, the Windsor, 1895, Pearson's, 1896, and many others. Aimed squarely at a popular readership, these periodicals were the major vehicle for the development and publication of the genre short story. More than this, Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine, the first of the great 19th century periodicals, founded as far back as 1817, had soon discovered a lucrative market for sensational horror fiction, a market which continued throughout the century's flourishing periodical culture and intensified with the welter of new arrivals in the 1890s. Doyle's connection with the periodicals was intimate. It was to the Strand magazine most particularly that he owed his success. His agent, A.P. Watt, sent one of his short stories, The Voice of Science, to Herbert Grinov Smith, editor of the newly founded periodical. It was published in the third edition of The Strand, March 1891, and marked the beginning of a long and mutually fruitful relationship between the author and the magazine. 4 months later, in July 1891, The Strand published the first Holmes short story, A Scandal in Bohemia, and Arthur Conan Doyle was a literary celebrity. No fewer than 15 of the stories in this volume were first published in The Strand. The great majority of the others, all but one in fact, the third generation, were published in The Idler, Pearson's, The Cornhill Magazine, or in one of a number of other magazines or newspapers. In writing his gothic tales for the periodicals then, Doyle was continuing a significant 19th century literary tradition. At the same time he was making a name for himself as a writer, Doyle also made himself very insistently into a public figure, in a manner which suggests that an acknowledged place of influence within the public sphere was central to his conception of himself. Indeed, as Douglas Kerr suggests, Doyle may well have been Britain's last national writer. He was, firstly, a committed correspondent to the press, as the editors of his letters, John Michael Gibson and Richard Lancelin Green, assert. Probably no other writer has ever before revealed quite such a range of interests or believed so fervently that he had the ear of society and therefore the right to address it on a variety of topics, as did Arthur Conan Doyle. His first published story, The Mystery of Sasasa Valley, appeared in Chambers Magazine in September 1879, the self-same month in which the British Medical Journal published his first letter, an extraordinary document in which the 20-year-old medical student discusses the results of a course of self-experimentation, having systematically poisoned himself with gelsemium, a motor paralyzer, notes Doyle, with effects that included headache with diarrhea and extreme lassitude. Though fortuitous, the simultaneous appearance of the story and the letter was not exactly happenstance, as Doyle clearly understood writing fiction and taking public positions to be related activities, each one enabling the other. From 1879, right up to his death in 1930, he was keen to communicate with great certainty and to a mass audience his opinions on a wide variety of subjects on which he generally took an uncompromising stance. Irish Home Rule, the Contagious Diseases Act, the Boer War, organized religion, trade protectionism, volunteer militias, mounted riflemen, massacres in the Congo, the desirability of a channel tunnel, German atrocities in the Great War, the need for reprisal against Zeppelin attacks, the reality of spiritualism. On these and numerous other subjects, the British public was never in doubt as to what Arthur Conan Doyle thought. He was, in fact, a frustrated politician, having twice stood unsuccessfully for Parliament on a Liberal Unionist ticket in Scottish constituencies in the 1900 and 1905 elections, and used his fame as a platform from which to express his social and political views. But the habitual confidence of his public utterances concealed, perhaps deliberately, contradictions beneath. One of the most fascinating things about Doyle is that he was such a conflicted or even a divided figure. He was, by training, a doctor, completely aware of the significance of scientific naturalism, and, in the figure of Sherlock Holmes, the creator of the foremost literary rationalist, a brilliant applied experimenter, and, like his creator, not past experimenting on himself, and thoroughgoing materialist. And yet, he was also increasingly drawn to spiritualism, for which he became a high-profile advocate, to the point many observers believed of utter self-damaging credulity. The educational institutions with which he was closely associated themselves expressed this duality, as he moved from the ultramontane anti-modernity of the Jesuit Academy Stonyhurst to the Enlightenment scientism of Edinburgh University Medical School. He later wrote with characteristically divided feelings about his Jesuit education. "Nothing can exceed the uncompromising bigotry of the Jesuit theology, or their apparent ignorance of how it shocks the modern conscience," he maintained. while acknowledging of the Jesuits that, in all ways save their theology, they were admirable. His Irish Catholic background on both sides of his family and his liberal unionist politics were in direct conflict with one another, to the extent that he reversed his views on Irish Home Rule, which he came to support in the 1910s. Andrew Lysett, one of Doyle's biographers, understands these dualities as the key to grasping his subject as a writer and a man, and traces them back to his home city of Edinburgh, a city of dynamic contrasts made tolerable by thoughtful accommodation. It is a city whose very geography is almost Freudian, a planned, rational, orderly, neoclassical new town, paired with a dark, rambling, and in the 19th century occasionally dangerous, old town, like the conscious and unconscious minds. It is the city which produced one of the great Gothic parables of the divided self, Robert Louis Stevenson's Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, published in 1886, shortly after Doyle's graduation from Edinburgh Medical School. Itself the setting for another of Stevenson's dualistic Gothic tales of public virtue and private vice, The Body Snatcher, 1884. This kind of conflict and duality is a central component of Victorian Gothic, and so it is no surprise that Doyle should be drawn to the form, and should return to it so frequently across the course of his career. Doyle's Gothic fiction often seeks out remote landscapes on the margins of British polity. Holmes is a fundamentally urban creation. His sensibilities are entirely metropolitan. He hates and fears rural life. The lowest and vilest alleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling and beautiful countryside. The Hound of the Baskervilles, 1902, perpetually on the verge of turning into a full-blooded Gothic novel, transforms remote Dartmoor into a phantasmagoric locale, like some fantastic landscape in a dream. All things are possible upon the moor, says the criminal mastermind Stapleton. But this was hardly Doyle's first fictional visit to Dartmoor. One of his very earliest stories, The Winning Shot, 1883, is set in Toynbee Hall, on the very edge of the great wilderness of Dartmoor, which stretched away to the horizon. To this far-flung spot, as though irresistibly drawn, comes the Swedish occultist and necromancer, Dr. Octavius Gaster, who makes a dramatic appearance at dusk, high on a rock, in a charnel house place, on the moor, where the water sounds like the gurgling in the throat of a dying man. Gaster is a kind of vampire. There was something about his angular proportions and the bloodless face which, taken in conjunction with the black cloak which fluttered from his shoulders, irresistibly reminded me of a blood-sucking species of bat. In a manner characteristic of much classic 19th-century Gothic, from Frankenstein to William Wilson to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde to the picture of Dorian Gray, The Winning Shot is a tale of the divided self. Gaster recites a spell from an ancient Arabic grimoire which enables him to split his rival, Charlie Pillar, in two, causing Charlie to shoot his own double and thus to kill himself. All things are indeed possible on the moor. An explicit echo of Dr. Gaster returns in a different form in The Surgeon of Gaster Fell, 1890, another Gothic tale of occultists on the moors, whose very title suggests the paired relationship with The Winning Shot. This is also a story which, if not straightforwardly autobiographical, certainly weaves together elements from Doyle's life. Like the slightly earlier Uncle Jeremy's Household, 1887, The Surgeon of Gaster Fell takes place on the fells of northeast Yorkshire, an area which Doyle knew well. Both these stories are based around a fictionalized version of the Yorkshire village of Masongill, where his mother lived from 1882 until 1917. In The Surgeon of Gaster Fell, James Upperton, a demobbed soldier, comes to the bleak and windswept, harsh and forbidding, lonely and secluded village of Kirk by Malthouse, seeking solitude in which to pursue his mystic studies into the possibility of human immortality, to be found in ancient Egyptian and Neoplatonic works. Upperton's neighbours, the local doctor and his beautiful sister, have come to Gaster Fell to keep a family secret. Their father, an exhausted Birmingham GP, has developed homicidal mania, and so his family have locked him away here, far from society. This is a grotesque refiguring of Doyle's own family history. His father, the artist Charles Alderman Doyle, may not have been a homicidal maniac, but he was a chronic alcoholic, prone to episodes of mental breakdown, who had a tendency, in Lysett's words, to violent and abusive behaviour, and spent the last years of his life in a series of mental asylums, where he was certainly classed in official documentation as a lunatic. The story of a doctor being summoned to care for a genteel lunatic is one to which Doyle returned several times. In his autobiographical novel, The Stark Munro Letters, 1895, young Dr. Munro, at one point, gets a job caring for the Honourable James Derwent, whose mental condition turns him into a foul-tongued rough. In the interview for the job, his prospective employer insists on asking for his height and weight, as the doctor will need to be sufficiently physically robust to restrain the lunatic if necessary. This very same episode is recycled for the gothic tale The Beetle Hunter, 1898, in which a newly qualified doctor answers a newspaper advertisement looking for a medical man, of strong physique, of steady nerves, and of a resolute nature, and finds himself caring for a distinguished aristocratic entomologist who has, once again, succumbed to homicidal mania. Understandably, Doyle was highly reluctant publicly to discuss his father's history. His autobiography makes no explicit mention of Charles Altman Doyle's alcoholism or his insanity. My father's health had utterly broken. He had to retire to that convalescent house in which the last 20 years of his life were spent. My father's life was full of the tragedy of unfulfilled promise and undeveloped gifts. He had his weaknesses, as all of us have ours, but he also had some remarkable and outstanding virtues. In ways that were perhaps unknown to himself, the Gothic, with its ability to explore extreme states of being and to give oblique articulation to the unspeakable, provided Doyle with a vehicle to explore the psychological consequence of this tragedy of unfulfilled promise. In December 1899, Doyle found himself in Hounslow, standing in a long queue of men who were waiting to enlist in the Middlesex Yeomanry. The Boer War had recently broken out in South Africa, and he was keen to enlist, but the regimental colonel, seeing in front of him a man of 40 with no military training or experience, had other ideas. And so, rather than serving as a soldier, Doyle travelled to Bloemfontein to work as a doctor in a military hospital, set up on a racecourse. There he had to deal with a virulent outbreak of enteric fever, which cost 5,000 lives. This, he recalled, was death in its vilest and filthiest forms. The disease causes constant pollution, and this pollution of the most dangerous kind, with the vilest effluvia. On returning to Britain, his first literary response to his experiences was not, as might perhaps be expected, a Gothic tale, but a history of the war, the Great Boer War, 1900. The book was controversial, not least in its justification of British concentration camps. One piece of hostile criticism in particular stuck in the author's mind. Doyle's book makes the impression that it was ordered or influenced by the English Jingo Party. His response to a criticism of the British conduct of the Boer War was an inspired exercise in propaganda. The war in South Africa, its cause and conduct, a mass circulation 6,000-word pamphlet. Doyle oversaw a vigorous campaign of subscriptions to ensure that the pamphlet was translated as quickly as possible into as many languages as possible, and in February 1902 wrote proudly to the Times that it was in the process of being translated not only into Dutch, for obvious reasons, as the Boers were the descendants of Dutch settlers, but also into German, French, Norwegian, Italian, Spanish, Russian, Hungarian, Portuguese, and Welsh. It was for the success of this campaign, for services not to literature, but to military propaganda, that Arthur Conan Doyle was knighted by King Edward VII in 1902. Doyle may not have been a jingoist, exactly, but he was a British imperialist to his bones. In fact, if one were to single out the major recurring explicit theme and preoccupation of his writing and thought, it would be his unwavering belief in and support for the British Empire. "I am an imperialist," he wrote to the Irish Times in 1912, "because I believe the whole to be greater than the part, and I would always willingly sacrifice any part if I thought it to the advantage of the whole." The British Empire underlay his own consciousness and sense of self, his national and supranational identity. "The Empire is in no sense an English thing. Scotch and Irish have combined in the building of it, and have an equal pride and interest in its immense future." In 1924, musing on a visit to Canada, he wrote rapturously of the future of the Empire, which will remain exactly as it is for the remainder of the century. Canadian imperialism is as warm or warmer than our own, and everywhere there is a consciousness of the glory of the Empire, its magnificent future, and the wonderful possibilities of those great nations all growing up under the same flag, and with the same language and destinies. Unquestionably, Doyle viewed the Imperial warfare as a kind of boy's own adventure. The British officer at his best, he came to realize, was really a large edition of the public schoolboy. During his Boer War time in Bloemfontein, he journeyed out onto the veldt, where he discovered the corpse of a nameless Australian soldier. So he met his end, somebody's boy. Fair fight, open air and a great cause. I know no better death. Consistently throughout his letters, Doyle bemoans the reluctance of the British Empire to propagandize on his own behalf. He himself exhibited no such reluctance, and was, as we have seen, a highly effective propagandist, for whom fiction was a potent tool. The White Company and Sir Nigel are extended peons to martial prowess. Near the beginning of The Lost World, the journalist Malone, chastised by his beloved Gladys, who wants to love a man of great deeds and strange experiences, like Sir Richard Burton or Henry Morton Stanley, is told by his editor that the big blank spaces on the map are all being filled in, and there's no room for romance anywhere. The Lost World does explicitly what many of Doyle's writings do by implication. It reinscribes a space for romance onto an increasingly utilitarian map of the world. A few years before his Boer War adventure, in 1896, Doyle had found himself visiting Egypt, and while he was there, had wrangled a press pass to cover a Mahdist uprising in Nubia, the next adventure which was opening up before both us and the British Empire. Doyle's fiction had already touched on Mahdism. Bellingham, the occult Egyptologist villain of Lot No. 249, 1892, is forced to leave England in disgrace, and was last heard of in the Sudan, presumably meddling in a Mahdist insurrection, while the Fenian conscripts of the Green Flag, 1893, ultimately recognize where their allegiances lie, and die a heroic death defending the empire in Sudan. The 1896 adventure provided Doyle with fresh impetus and material, and led to the publication of the autobiographical The Three Correspondents, 1896, the extraordinarily pro-imperialist novel The Tragedy of the Korosko, 1898, but serialized in 1897, and the debut of Bimbashi Joyce, 1900, another tale of an Irish soldier coming good in Egypt and the Sudan. The Mahdist wars of the 1890s were to culminate in the Battle of Omdurman on the 2nd of September 1898, the most one-sided massacre in British imperial history, in which the Maxim guns of the British army cut down 10,000 Mahdist soldiers, many of whom were armed only with assegai spears. This was not, it should be noted, how Doyle himself saw events. The Arab of the Sudan is a desperate fanatic who rushes to death with the frenzy of a madman and longs for close quarters where he can bury his spear in the body of his foeman, even though he carries several bullets in him before he reaches him. As Sven Lindqvist notes, it was to prevent such wounded death charges that the exploding dum-dum bullet was developed, named after the factory outside Dum-Dum in Calcutta, and patented in 1897. The use of dum-dum bullets between civilized states was prohibited. They were reserved for big game hunting and colonial wars. Doyle himself raises the use of exploding bullets in his defense of the British conduct of the Boer War, noting that the British, whose wars are usually against savages, had prepared huge quantities of soft-nosed dum-dum bullets. It is only just to say, however, that they were never intended to be used against white races. But Doyle's assertive public confidence in the civilizing mission of the British Empire is not borne out by a reading of the Gothic tales, whose sensibilities are more modern, or at least the stories seem more amenable to modern sensibilities. These tales are full of anxieties about the vengeful or monstrous capabilities and consequences of imperialism. In a manner unusually explicit for Doyle, the supernatural tale De Profundis, 1892, opens with a recognition that for the success of the great broadcast British Empire, a price must be paid, and the price is a grievous one. As the beast of old must have one young human life as a tribute every year, so to our empire we throw from day to day the pick and flower of our youth. The empire, then, is a monster, devouring the nation's youth. In a further recurring exploration of this Gothic image, one group of Doyle's stories deals with exotic creatures wreaking havoc either in the colonies, or worse, on British soil. As Christopher Frayling notes, Doyle was much given to tales of biology run amok, and particularly of monstrous beasts giving nightmares to the aristocracy of Deep England. These tales are Doyle's most idiosyncratic contribution to the fictional explorations of the common fin de siècle cultural anxiety of reverse colonization, which saw a series of continental, oriental, imperial, or interplanetary others wreaking havoc upon British soil. In 1897 alone, the year of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, which might be said to mark the high point of British imperialism, three canonical works of reverse colonization were published: Bram Stoker's Dracula, Richard Marsh's The Beetle, and in serial form, H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds. A number of Doyle's stories from the 1890s, The Ring of Thoth, Lot No. 249, The Case of Lady Sannox, The Fiend of the Cooperage, The Brazilian Cat, The Brown Hand, as well as numerous of the Holmes stories, notably The Sign of Four, 1890, and The Speckled Band, 1892, are classic tales of colonial horror, shot through with a variety of imperial anxieties. Fresh out of medical school in the early 1880s, and looking for occupation and adventure, the young Doyle signed as ship's doctor on a couple of sea voyages that were straight out of the imperial adventure romance. In 1880, he spent several months upon the whaling ship Hope, working the far northern waters around Greenland, a region of romance, he was to recall many years later, where you stand on the very brink of the unknown, a land which the maps know not. More influential for Doyle was his voyage to West Africa on board the Mayumba in 1881-82, which was to provide him with the genesis of a decades-long imaginative and political engagement with the region. His initial response to Africa, as recalled in his autobiography, is clearly spoken through by the classic racist discourse of the civilizing mission of European colonialism. Africa is a savage and exotic land. The natives were all absolute savages, offering up human sacrifices to snakes and crocodiles. The captain had heard the screams of the victims and seen them dragged down to the water's edge, while on another occasion he had seen the protruding skull of a man who had been buried in an ant heap. It is all very well to make game of the missionaries, but how are such people ever to be improved if it were not for the labours of devoted men? All of which sounds as though it might have come straight out of the report for the Society for the Suppression of Savage Customs, which Kurtz had prepared in Conrad's Heart of Darkness, 1899, and whose mad logic drives him to the notorious conclusion, "Exterminate all the brutes." But the truth of Doyle's engagement with West Africa was more nuanced. One of the Mayumba's passengers was Henry Highland Garnet, an African-American diplomat, and the most intelligent and well-read man whom I met on the coast. Garnet educated Doyle in the complexities of European-African cultural exchanges. "The only way to explore Africa," he told Doyle, "is to go without arms and with few servants. You would not like it in England if a body of men came armed to the teeth and marched through your land. The Africans are quite as sensitive. It was the method of Livingstone as against the method of Stanley. The former takes the braver and better man." Doyle's first fictional engagement with the implications of this journey was the riotously imaginative J. Habakkuk Jephson statement, 1884, which weaves together the mystery of the Mary Celeste, discovered floating crewless in the North Atlantic in 1872, and the founding of the West African Republic of Liberia by freed American slaves in 1847, into a tale of a murderous African-American separatist, Septimus Goring. Goring explains his political intentions to the narrator, the abolitionist Dr. Jephson. "I determined to find some bold, free black people, and throw in my lot with them, to cultivate their latent powers, and to form a nucleus of a great colored nation." Cast adrift in the Atlantic at the end of the story, Jephson is picked up by the British and African Steam Navigation Company's boat, Monrovia, named in honor of the capital of Liberia. Journeying through the dark and terrible mangrove swamps of Creektown, a former slave port on the Nigerian coast, where nothing that is not horrible could exist, a foul place, Doyle recalled, glimpsing a native monster. "Once, in an isolated tree, standing in a flood, I saw an evil-looking snake, worm-colored and about 3 feet long. This episode underwent an extraordinary Gothic transformation to become one of Doyle's most remarkable tales of colonial anxiety, The Fiend of the Cooperage, 1897, in which a giant West African python, which is consistently imagined in terms of queer voodoo tales and voodoo devilry, horribly kills Walker, a colonial agent of good, stiff, unionist politics and a decent, God-fearing 19th-century Primrose League Englishman. Walker's colleague, the rank radical Dr. Severall, a supporter of Irish Home Rule, explains that their outpost is situated just upon the edge of the great unknown, an undiscovered country, the home of exotic fauna. That is the Gaboon country, the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?